Now the Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Ortsey. Lady Blakeney, Marguerite St. Just, has obtained information that could lead to the unmasking of the elusive Scarlet Pimpernel, and thus save her brother from the guillotine. But will she pass it on to Chauvelin? One thing is certain. Whatever she does, an innocent man will go to the guillotine. Part 4, Richmond, read by Damian Lewis.
After supper, with the clock ticking mercilessly on, Marguerite had once more found her way to the tiny boudoir still deserted. She had made her choice. Armand must be saved at any cost. As for the stranger, well, perhaps the Scarlet Pimpernel, who for so many months had baffled an army of spies, would still manage to escape. She saw Chauvelin peering through the curtained doorway. He slipped into the room.
"You have news for me," he said.
"Nothing of importance," she said, "but it might prove a clue. I contrived, no matter how, to detect Sir Andrew Ffoulkes in the very act of burning a paper at one of these candles in this very room. That paper I succeeded in holding between my fingers and casting my eyes on it for 10 seconds.
"Time enough to learn its contents?" asked Chauvelin.
She nodded. In the corner of the paper, there was the usual rough device of a small star-shaped flower. Above it, I read 2 lines. Everything else was scorched and blackened by the flame.
And what were the 2 lines?
One was, "I start myself tomorrow." The other, "If you wish to speak to me, I shall be in the supper room at 1 o'clock precisely." Chauvelin looked up at the clock just above the mantelpiece. "What are you going to do?" she asked.
"It will depend on whom I shall see in the supper room at 1 o'clock precisely."
"You will see the Scarlet Pimpernel, of course. But you do not know him, and there may be more than one."
"Whoever is there, as the clock strikes 1, will be shadowed by my men."
"Yes, and?"
"Since it seems that he has now decided not to send his emissaries, but go himself tomorrow, one of the persons whom I shall see anon in the supper room will be journeying to Calais. I shall follow that person, for that person, fair lady, will be the Scarlet Pimpernel."
And with a deep and elaborate bow, Chauvelin glided out of the room. When Chauvelin reached the supper room, it was quite deserted. But his plans were well laid. He felt sure that the Scarlet Pimpernel had not been warned, and he felt equally sure that Marguerite Blakeney had not played him false. As he surveyed the solitude of the room, he became aware of the peaceful, monotonous breathing of one of Lord Grenville's guests, who, no doubt, had supped both wisely and well, and was enjoying a quiet sleep away from the din of the dancing above. He looked round once more, and there in the corner of a sofa, in the dark angle of the room, his mouth open, his eyes shut, the sounds of peaceful slumber proceeding from his nostrils, reclined the gorgeously apparelled, long-limbed husband of the cleverest woman in Europe. Evidently the slumberer, deep in dreamless sleep, would not interfere with Chauvelin's trap. And so, taking a pinch of snuff, he too stretched himself out in the corner of another sofa, shut his eyes, and waited. Marguerite sat listlessly in the small boudoir, looking out through the curtained doorway on the dancing couples beyond. The time passed, and Chauvelin did not return. Had he failed? For one instant, that possibility rose before her as a hope, the hope that the Scarlet Pimpernel had been warned by Sir Andrew, but that hope soon gave way to fear. If he failed, then what of Armand? Presently, Lord Grenville himself came to tell her that her coach was ready and that Sir Percy was waiting for her. Just after she had taken final leave of her host, she saw Chauvelin coming up the stairs slowly, rubbing his thin hands very softly together. There was a curious look on his face, partly amused and wholly puzzled. "Monsieur Chauvelin," she said, as he stopped on the top of the stairs, bowing elaborately before her. "My coach is outside. May I claim your arm?" As gallant as ever, he offered her his arm and led her downstairs. "Chauvelin," she said at last, desperately, "I must know what happened in the supper room at 1 o'clock just now." "Quiet and peace reign supreme, fair lady. At that hour I was asleep in one corner of one sofa, and Sir Percy Blakeney in another." "Nobody came into the room at all?"
"Nobody."
"Then we have failed, you and I?"
"Yes, we have failed. Perhaps."
"But Armand?" she pleaded.
"Ah, Armand Saint-Just's chances hung on a thread. At the present moment, dear lady, you must hope, as I do, that the Scarlet Pimpernel will start for Calais today."
"I am only conscious of one hope, citoyen."
"And that is?"
"That Satan, your master, will have need of you elsewhere before the sun rises."
A few minutes later, Marguerite was sitting next to Sir Percy, on the box seat of his coach, as the four splendid bays thundered along the quiet streets towards Richmond. His face in the moonlight looked singularly earnest, and recalled to Marguerite's aching heart those happy days of courtship before he had become the lazy nincompoop, the effete fop, whose life seemed spent in card and supper rooms. But as she felt her husband's strong arm beside her, she also felt how much more he would dislike and despise her if he knew of this night's work. Buried in her thoughts, Marguerite suddenly realized that the coach had turned into the massive gates of Sir Percy's palatial home on the river. Sir Percy jumped down quickly, then helped Marguerite to alight. Whilst he gave orders to one of his men, she skirted the house and stepped onto the lawn, looking out dreamily into the silvery landscape. Never had she felt so lonely, so bitterly in want of comfort and of sympathy. With a sigh, she turned away from the river towards the house, wondering if, after such a night, she could ever find rest and sleep. Before she reached the terrace, she heard a firm step upon the crisp gravel, and the next moment her husband's figure emerged out of the shadow. He, too, was wandering along the lawn towards the river. He apparently did not notice her, for after a few moments' pause, he presently turned back towards the house and walked straight up to the terrace. "Sir Percy!" He already had one foot on the lowest of the terrace steps, but at her voice he started and paused, then looked searchingly into the shadows whence she had called to him. She came forward quickly into the moonlight, and as soon as he saw her, he said with that air of consummate gallantry he always wore when speaking to her, "At your service, madame." But his foot was still on the step, and his whole attitude suggested that he had no desire for a midnight interview. "The air is deliciously cool," she said. "The moonlight peaceful and poetic, and the garden inviting. Will you not stay in it a while? The hour is not yet late, or is my company so distasteful to you that you are in a hurry to rid yourself of it?"
"Nay, madame," he rejoined placidly, "but 'tis on the other foot the shoe happens to be. And I'll warrant you'll find the midnight air more poetic without my company."
He turned once more to go. "I protest, you mistake me, Sir Percy," she said hurriedly, drawing a little closer to him. "The estrangement which, alas, has arisen between us was none of my making, remember."
"Begad, you must pardon me there, madame," he protested coldly. "My memory was always of the shortest."
"Percy, I entreat you," she whispered. "Can we not bury the past?"
24 hours after our marriage, madame, the Marquis de Saint-Cyr and all his family perished on the guillotine, and the popular rumour reached me that it was the wife of Sir Percy Blakeney who helped to send them there."
"Nay, I myself told you the truth of that odious tale,
not till after it had been recounted to me by strangers."
"And you believed them, without proof or question?"
"It is perhaps a little difficult, madame," said Sir Percy, after a moment of silence between them, "to go back over the past. I confessed to you that my memory was short. but the thought certainly lingered in my mind that I entreated you for an explanation of those same noisome popular rumours. If my memory does not, even now, play me a trick, I fancy that you refused me all explanation then.
I wished to test your love for me, and it did not bear the test. And to probe that love, you demanded that I should forfeit mine honour. Had you but spoken one word, I should have believed it.
Listen to me now, Sir Percy, she said. Armand was all in all to me. The Marquis de Saint-Cyr had him thrashed by his lackeys. His offence? That he, a plebeian, dared to love his daughter, the daughter of an aristocrat. I only thought to bring that proud Marquis to trouble and humiliation. When I realized what I had done, it was too late. Though up to the very morning that he went to the guillotine, I was using every influence I possessed to save him and his family. But my pride sealed my lips when your love seemed to perish as if under the knife of that same guillotine.
In the dim, grey light of early dawn, his tall form looked taller and more rigid. Marguerite, excited as she was, could see that his eyes were no longer languid, that a look of intense passion glowed from beneath his lids. But his mouth was tightly closed, his lips compressed, as if his will alone held that passion in check. Marguerite knew in a moment that this man who stood here before her loved her still, as he had loved her a year ago, that pride had kept him from her. The trouble, the sorrow she had gone through last night suddenly came back into her mind, but no longer with bitterness, rather with a feeling that this man who loved her would help her bear the burden.
"Sir Percy," she said impulsively, "I wished to speak to you because I was in trouble and had need of your sympathy."
"It is yours to command, madame."
"Percy, Armand is in deadly danger. A letter of his written to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes has fallen into the hands of a fanatic. He is hopelessly compromised. Tomorrow, perhaps he will be arrested. After that, the guillotine," she said, with a sudden wail of anguish, as all the events of the past night came rushing back to her mind. "And I have no one to whom I can turn for help."
At first mention of Armand Saint-Just's name, and of the peril in which he stood, Sir Percy's face had become a shade more pale.
"And so," he said with bitter sarcasm, "the murderous dog of the revolution is turning upon the very hands that fed it."
"Can you do aught for Armand?" she said. "You have so much influence at court, so many friends."
"Nay, madame, should you not seek the influence of your French friend, Monsieur Chauvelin? His extends, if I mistake not, even as far as the Republican government of France."
"I cannot ask him, Percy. Go, I wish I dared to tell you, but he has put a price on my brother's head."
She would have given worlds if she had felt the courage then to tell him everything she had done that night, how she had suffered and how her hand had been forced. But she dared not give way to that impulse, not now, when she was just beginning to feel that he still loved her, when she hoped that she could win him back. She dared not make another confession to him. Perhaps he divined what was passing in her mind. His whole attitude was one of intense longing for that confidence, which her foolish pride withheld from him. When she remained silent, he sighed, and said with marked coldness, "Faith, madame, since it distresses you, we will not speak of it. As for Armand, I pray you have no fear. I pledge you my word that he shall be safe. Now, it is late, and—"
He stood aside to allow her to pass. She sighed, a quick sigh of disappointment. His pride and her beauty had been in direct conflict, and his pride had remained the conqueror.
Damian Lewis has been reading part 4 of The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Ortsey. The book is abridged by Sarah Kilgariff and is a CSA Word production for BBC Radio 2 by Clive Stanhope. Next week, Marguerite Blakeney herself discovers the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel.